Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talk to Eli Ritter, whose voice we have not heard in a while on this podcast feed. There's been a lot of news in Guelph lately, maybe too much news, so we're going to take a minute or 60 on this week's podcast to bring some analysis and recap all the happenings in this sordid little burb that we call the Royal City. Guelph stuff is the topic of this week's Guelph Politicast. So this week's episode is a longer one, so I will make this introduction brief, especially since I've done a lot of talking already. We're going to cover three main topics: the Black Lives Matter protest and the developing debates around systemic racism and police powers, the City of Guelph's response to COVID-19 and the economic reopening, and then finally we will talk about the arrest of Marwan Tabara in Guelph back in April and why we didn't know about it until a few weeks ago. So, without further ado, let's get into that Guelph stuff. I caught up with Eli Ritter earlier this week via Skype. Eli Ritter, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me again.
We haven't seen each other physically in person since the Black Lives Matter protest on June the 6th. Did you get COVID from being out and about? I didn't get COVID. At least I don't think I did. I haven't felt symptomatic, but...
Stick a Q-tip to the back of my throat, but I think I'm good. I don't think I caught it.
good.
That's right. Yeah.
I think it's the back of your nose.
Oh, okay. That's what it is. Whoops.
Well, that's all right. I'm pretty sure. Actually, I think that maybe there are the two tests. There is the throat swab, which they do take at anyway. This isn't a medical show. So what did you think? Covering that protest, I know that, you know, I was pretty amazed to see 5,000 people in the core protesting anything, let alone Black Lives Matter here in, you know, what's still predominantly lily white Guelph. But you know, what did you think?
Yeah, well, it was good to be in Guelph again, doing a Guelph story, because that's been a while to start off. But it was weird going back with crowds of people again after being in a house for so long. A little spooky, but I'm glad they had that media area where we had lots of space, and then we were ahead of the crowd, which is good. But yeah, it was like the energy was just really reverberating. Like it was pretty fantastic energy that was going on there, and I like you said, like it was very interesting to see that in what quote-unquote lily white Guelph. And and it was cool to see people coming together. It looks like of a variety of backgrounds, and to support a movement that is very important right now. And it seems like Guelph was making it clear that this is what they were standing for.
Mm-hmm. I would say. Mm-hmm.
How about you?
Well, I say lily white Guelph kind of facetiously because I know that there's a great deal of diversity here in Guelph, and you see that when you're just out and about, you know, when you can go out and about, you know, when you're around town, you see people from all sorts of backgrounds. But, you know, for the most part, political protests are a lily white crowd. And I mean, a lot of that is, you know, you see a lot of the same faces. You go to the protests, whether it's about climate change, whether it's about water, whatever, it's a lot of the usual suspects, so to speak. And one of the things I found refreshing was, although I did see some of the usual suspects, it was mostly unusual suspects in terms of people I don't typically see out protesting. And definitely people of color, the black and indigenous people of color who do not typically take part in protests. And it's been interesting to see those people engage because, I shouldn't say those people, but it's interesting to see that community engage because I feel like, you know, at various levels, we don't engage with that community fairly well. Even just covering city council, I think I made this point in one of the Today columns I wrote, that even when the police budget came up for discussion last budget period back in November, December, there weren't any people of color there to delegate. And I think that there was, I think there's a genuine concern on the part of some people of color in our community that they can't really talk about that stuff, or that they couldn't talk about them, that kind of stuff until recent events, that maybe there was an unintended racial barrier to coming to city council. And just generally, you don't see people of color delegating at city council or are terribly involved in city politics. And that's kind of like the long-term thing that has to be overcome, that hopefully the protests address and hopefully gets more people involved. And of course, I want to preface this by saying all this is coming from a couple of white guys, one old white guy, one young white guy. And yeah.
Hey, you're not that old, don't worry about it. No, but you're right. Like, I think you're bang on with that, is that you don't see a lot of people, a lot of different minorities coming to city council. And maybe there will be a boost now with, there's obvious leaders in what I would call the BIPOC community, you know, Black, Indigenous, and people of color of that community that have made themselves very clear now. Not that they weren't leaders before, but they're very present in the news and everything now, that maybe those people you'll start to see at city council next budget period. Maybe they'll be there and they'll be, putting their voice forward and contributing to that conversation on that level. And they're, of course, already contributing to the conversation, but at City Hall specifically, we'll see that. What did you think about, what I found really interesting for me is that we've seen a lot of other cities, where the police chief has come out or police officers have knelt with protesters. And I know that the organizers of this particular march asked that politicians and the chief did not come. But I'm curious, like, what you thought, you know, if maybe the officers, if they had a chance to kneel, like, I wonder, I would almost expect that solidarity from Guelph. And maybe that shows that I don't know it as well as I do, or it just wasn't that opportunity. But I found that interesting that that didn't happen here.
No, and it was interesting, too, that the only police I saw was when the march was happening and they were kind of shutting down roads so that the marchers could go up the street safely. And I was in St. George's Square when they came up Wyndham. And yeah, the only police I saw were the ones at the corner of Quebec Street, making sure that people wouldn't, drive into the march. I'm of two minds on that. I think there is something about seeing the solidarity from people in power taking a knee. I'm thinking particularly of Justin Trudeau, when he went to the Black Lives Matter protest in Ottawa, where he took a knee. At the same time, though, I've been seeing some people make the comments, drag Trudeau for taking a knee when he's the prime minister and has an awful lot of leverage to take actual action and not just, personally take a knee. And I think that's valid, too, that I think that the people who are concerned about systemic change and wanting systemic change, aren't really worried about the performative aspect of this in terms of like seeing people in uniform taking a knee. I think what they're kind of chasing in particular is how those people in power and in authority can take action to change things on the systemic level and not just on the individualistic personal level of taking a knee when you're at a protest.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I see where you're getting at. It's about, the real action that could come from that. Yeah, I see where you're going with that. And I think, if that's what the organizers, asked for, and they didn't ask for that to happen or request that or set that up in any way, then that's not something they were looking for, right? Like, that wasn't part of this particular march's goal or objective.
Right. I think there was, because all the speakers, all the performers and stuff were people of color. I think that the intention, and I don't want to, and I'm going by, you know, the conversations I had with Kayla Gerber, and just being there and seeing what happens. I think the intention was to create a space where people of color can come in and do the talking. And, you know, there's always going to be a platform for the mayor, for the chief of police, for city councilors, for the MP, the MPP, etc. They were creating a platform for their voice. And in that regard, I think that they were right to sort of ask for the sort of the regular, the people who can take advantage of just about any platform, ask them to sort of take a day and not participate and then come back the next day if they wanted to share their two cents. And I think that was valid. I think what I would like to see now is, if the intent is to have a community conversation, I want to see that conversation happen in the community. And yes, I understand that meetings have been happening between Guelph Black Heritage Society and the police and the mayor, and there's been a conversation too. But I also think it would help to sort of have something more happening in the community too, whether that's in the form of like a Zoom town hall, which I know there's a Zoom town hall coming up this weekend with the chief and the War II counselors, but I would like to see, I would like to see a bit more community engagement. And I, again, knowing that community engagement is happening, but I want to see the community engagement. And I think a lot of people want to see that happening too.
Public town hall. And I guess, you know, as a side note, there is efforts at the school board level, at least at the Upper Grand District School Board, and I know the Catholic School Board is thinking about this, but they're looking at police presence in schools, and that's, you know, clearly a direct result of everything that's occurred since the death of George Floyd, and they're really talking about it, and they're considering it, and, you know, and this is a mostly white or all white, you know, trustee board that's talking about these issues, and I believe that there's an effort by one of the trustees, Mike Foley, to have a open town hall and kind of what you're talking about, and but only at the school board level. And that's, you know, one way that people can participate, families and things like that, in the school level community. And so there seems to be some efforts to do that kind of thing. And I can see how a you know, a citywide open town hall would be a great way to take the next step after the protests. You know, what actions can we take? Hold the leaders that are elected accountable and go from there, I guess.
Did you see the agenda for the Upper Grand Board meeting for tonight?
I believe that's the one where they're voting on the police presence.
Well, it's the regular meeting, so they're voting all kinds of things. But I think one of the new conditions in the police presence motion is for a community event or a town hall at the end of July. I just kind of glanced at it, but I, for some strange reason, I think that's a thing, but I'll have to double check. But, you know, so, I mean, it's going to happen, at some point too, at least at the Upper Grand level, which, if people saw the meeting or the coverage of the meeting knows that, there was a lot of good faith efforts at that meeting, but a lot of people were concerned about how the motion was worded about establishing a task force to look at the police presence in the schools.
There was some technical issues. Yeah, I was following along with that, and that was they want to do it. They want to move ahead with that, but they just needed some corrections to fix that. And to confirm, I'm looking at the minutes now, and it is to have that town hall. And that's the one that was, I believe, pushed by Mike Foley and some other trustees. So that's the one to be passed tonight, probably. And you'll have a town hall. So that'll be something. And it's by July 31st. So, you know, in the next month, we'll see that town hall. So pretty fast.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think quick action is key, because I think people want to sort of strike while it's hot. Of course, things have been hot for almost a month now. So it does make you wonder how long that energy can be sustained. But yeah, I think people want to see action sooner rather than later. So that'll be interesting to see if they can get that town hall together before the end of July.
Yeah, absolutely.
There was also the Police Services Board meeting last week with a series of measures that was brought by Mayor Guthrie, who's on the board. There has been blowback since, and I do want to let you give you a chance to sort of talk about that, because you've been sort of covering that social media blowback about the mayor's comment about how it, again, it was about, it was a weird situation because there was a motions about responding to the Black Lives Matter concern, and then there was another trio of motions which were addressing the budget in particular and having a 0% budget increase for 2021, which I think a lot of people read into that was a response to the defund the police sort of subheading of the Black Lives Matter protest. But in the course of the meeting, it was clarified that it had more to do with the response to COVID. It was in response to Black Lives Matter, and Mayor Guthrie posted to social media that he is interested in not punishing the police, but helping them achieve better.
Well, yeah, and so that statement that he put out on June 18th is, no, I do not support defunding our police out of a desire to punish them. I'm not here to punish the good men and women of our service who do one heck of a good job caring for our city. And then he added in a thread the next day, reallocation, ? Reprioritizing, fine. Reevaluate, fine. Fundamental changes for the betterment of the service, fine. But a starting point to punish, no. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those, the defund the police movement, a lot of it is focused on that reallocation of funding, not necessarily saying, okay, the police get $0 now from the city. It's more of a bringing things over from the police and putting more towards social services that can respond to certain emergency calls and are, you know, things for those who are vulnerable in their city and those who are homeless. Like, there's different approaches that can be taken by different people, not necessarily the police. And there's been different models in the states and around the world that have used this to varying success. But yeah, so he put out the statement, and then there was kind of a bit of a backlash on social media across Facebook and Twitter and you name it. And you know, he was kind of defending the different things. And Kevin Sutton, who is one of the founders of the local Guelph Black Lives Matter, said that basically we are not seeking punishment and we're seeking an end to punishment. And I'll read this one part of his statement because I think it's important. We are seeking an end to police brutality and an end to racist targeting of the BIPOC community by law enforcement, the justice system, the education system, the healthcare system, housing, and all other systems of service. So he's making it clear that, you know, that's not what they're asking for. But he also made it clear in the conversations I had with him that, you know, he wasn't seeing it as something completely negative at the time. It was he said that it was a chance to have a conversation and to talk more for him.
His conversation with on social media with the mayor, you mean?
Yeah, so he was saying that, like, the idea of saying no punish from the mayor, he said that actually that could be the mayor deflecting it back at, you know, critics who are saying that he is trying to punish the police when he's really trying to honestly take up the idea of maybe reallocating funds or whatever it is, when he's trying to engage with that. But there's a lot of people that took it as people read it a lot of different ways. But Kevin, for him, he said that it was just, he wasn't mad, he wasn't really angry, but it was an opportunity for there to be a further conversation.
Right. Yeah, I think, I mean, there's a lot of heightened emotions over this too. I think I understand where Cam was coming from. I think what's happened is it's kind of got hung up on this whole thing, like, I don't want to punish, and I don't think it was ever about punishment, at least, you know, at least from the the main point of the defund the police. And I think when you kind of talk to people about that, the idea is basically that we're asking the police to do so much that is outside the realm of what we acknowledge as, you know, sort of the main job description of the police, which is to prevent and investigate crimes and violations of the law. It is not necessarily the responsibility of the police to do things like wellness checks or to follow up on, you know, allegations of domestic violence or that kind of thing. Or at the very least, it should not be a solely police responsibility. I can understand for like the safety of like, you know, sending a social worker, but for the safety of the social worker, maybe having a police officer there, like maybe having a combined kind of presence. You know, the point being too that, you know, on the one side, the social services are drastically underfunded, while the police would argue that they've been underfunded for a while too, which is why they asked for the 10% increase last budget. But at the same time, when the police come to city council and say, we need a 10% budget increase, it kind of goes through. While social services groups come in and say, we need a 10% increase, you know, they'll say, well, how about two? Right? It's a matter of, I guess, the perception of, you know, who has more, you know, has more power to, and who has more. Well, I guess power is it too, because one of the reasons why the budget increases go through so easily is because of the oversight of the police boards, that, you know, the city turns down their request for more funds. It goes to the Ontario Police Commission Review Board. I think I'll have to look that up, but it goes to this board, and more often than not, because it is involving policing, that board will override the decision of the city to, you know, cut funding or not approve increased funding. So, for social services, there are all these barriers to getting more funding. They're constantly being asked to do more with less. Meanwhile, when the police ask for more, they do typically get it without much of a fuss.
Right. And you've seen a lot of sort of in-depth stories pop up from American and Canadian media talking about the police funding. And what I've seen a lot is that the cities have less power over police funding than some people thought they did. Mm. And I've been kind of learning that too. And it's interesting what you're saying, how it can rise to the next level and, you know, they can kind of get what they want in the end. And the social services don't have that same leverage, it seems. And maybe that's, you know, and that's something that can be done at the legislative level. I don't know if that's a provincial or federal thing. But like you said about leaders, you know, taking certain types of real action, maybe that's something they'll be looking at if also taking a knee, but, you know, also taking that real action. Maybe that's something they can look at with the budgetary stuff. And I think council, like next time they talk about the budget, I'm assuming now that there's going to be a lot more eyes on the police funding. And I know there was last time, there was a lot of interest in that because of the big increase, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder now if you're going to see, people coming to city council and talking about it from, as you said, beyond the usual suspects. Because now it's, and we'll have to see how that energy carries. But I mean, if this new Black Lives Matter chapter is now being established, and you know the leaders of this as well, and people that are involved in this movement, is that these are people that aren't going to just kind of fizzle out. Like, they're going to be around, and they're going to fight for the things that this organization wants to stand for. And I won't speak for them, but I'm sure that they're, you know, ready and willing to go and tackle things on multiple fronts. And that could include city council and delegations there and whatever it could be with that.
Right. It's a matter of how the conversation changed because is changing or has changed. That when it came forward last fall about the police budget increase, it was all about responding to sort of the property crimes that are going on, how Guelph has lost its place as, you know, one of the most safest communities in Canada. It used to be number one, then it was number two, and now it's sort of in the top 20. Still relatively safe, but, not as prestigious as being the safest community in the country. Having said that, in the same period, we've seen Guelph become one of the top 10 places in Canada where there are hate crimes, where there's been an increase in hate crimes. And we kind of have the two things are kind of held separately, that we've had an increase in property crime. We've had an increase of hate crime, but what's the one we choose to, choose to pursue as the more immediate threat? It's the property crime.
Right. Yeah. And so the hate crime and what could be sidelined as social issues or whatnot like that. Yeah. That's kind of an interesting, thing or comment. I like that comment basically. Like, to go one way or the other and kind of what you're going to choose. Has there been a lot, and because I haven't been in Guelph too much in the last year, has there been, you know, distinct decisions made by the police board or by even city council where they're choosing one or the other beyond the budget?
I don't think it comes up. I honestly don't think it comes up because I think there's a narrative, at least the one that the city hall likes to cultivate in its own. So, like when you're developing things like the strategic plan, or the shared agenda of council and those sorts of things, that there's an emphasis on, you know, hey, we're all Guelph and we're all cool together and we all hang out and we're all best friends. When I think there are entire communities in Guelph that, like, kind of do not feel engaged and feel kind of marginalized. Because, again, you sort of see the usual suspects responding to those surveys and responding to those calls and coming out to the town halls and the different events. And so, yeah, I don't think we generally deal with, you know, our newfound place in the top 10 of hate crimes in Canada. I think it's something we don't want to talk about, and I think it's something that makes us feel uncomfortable to think that, you know, Guelphiness is not a universal concept, because there are people in Guelph who don't very much feel like being with some people who are, don't feel like being best friends with people who are of a different skin color or a different ethnicity or a different orientation or whatever, that Guelphiness is not a universal constant.
Right. And do you think, someone that's watched politics in Guelph for a long time, do you think that if we have, in the coming elections, in the coming years, municipal, federal, provincial, federal could be right around the corner, who knows, do you think that we'll see more, or I don't know if I want to use the term more, but do you think we'll see minority candidates that crop up that have more support than as typically in the past? Because, well, one, we haven't seen too many minority candidates in the past, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in recent years, there was a lot in the last city council run. Do you think now that maybe there could be more support if they're running on these issues of, let's talk about police, let's talk about the hate crimes, let's talk about, BIPOC issues. Do you think that movement is big enough and motivated enough to propel people to office or change the landscape in Guelph politically?
I mean, it's a good question. I would hope so. Because, you know, there was certainly a lot of diversity on the slate. And, by saying a lot of diversity, I mean there was some diversity. You know, candidates like, you know, Jody Belly, who did win her trustee race in Ward 6 in Pouce Lynch, and Indu Arora, who ran against you, famously, here in Ward 4. Jonathan in Ward 2. There was definitely more diversity in the race, which was, I was glad to see. Whether or not maybe there's more of a drive now, you know, now that sort of like the issues of why we need more diversity are sort of more pronounced and more front of mind, whether that will give, I don't want to say an advantage because that feels like the wrong word, but give more attention, more credence to the need to have more diversity on city council itself. Well, that election is 2 years out, so I guess that depends how successful we are in sort of keeping diversity issues front and center. Because, I mean, again, it's been over a month since George Floyd was killed on camera, and we're still seeing the the reaction to that. And we live in a news cycle where it's over, snap, and things are over. You know, so a month feels like a lifetime now.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
I, you know, 2 years feels like multiple lifetimes. I guess that's a question to be determined. I will say that I think the onus is on, sadly, yes, the BIPOC community and other marginalized communities in Guelph to keep more diversity and more representation in those issues front of mind. I think it is also on us in the media to do the same.
Right, that makes sense. And I mean, we do have to point out that, yeah, there were more people of different backgrounds elected the last municipal election, right? And then we've also had some different candidates of different backgrounds federally, which mm-hmm. was pretty good to see. And New Aurora almost made it pretty close to council there. So
yeah, she did. Yeah, that's right.
Tightest.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, it's hard to say with 2014 too. You know, 2014 was one of those weird election years where there was kind of like no drive for change. It was a very kind of status quo-y election, and that was kind of like a universal thing across the province. There were very few like real upsets and turnarounds. I mean, the most notable one I can think of is probably Cambridge, where Doug Craig was ousted as mayor after years and years and years of basically kind of seemed like pro forma re-elections, but that was the exception rather than the rule. And the question is, I said 2014, it was 2018. Where the hell is my brain? So I guess in 2022, we'll see if maybe there's, if that becomes a change election. I guess that's to be determined too.
Yeah, we'll see how that carries over.
Yeah. We've spent half an hour talking about this and we had like three topics lined up, so we'll have to do a bit of lightning round. The COVID-19 response, you know, there's been a lot happening lately with the debate over who's wearing masks and where you have to wear a mask, the announcement of the patio program to create some, I'm going to call it emergency patio space. And then, of course, we've had announcements in the last few days that Market Squared, the splash pad there, will be opening before the end of the month. Actually, I have to double check that. It might be after the start of the month. Service Guelph is now open, so you can now buy your bus passes and pay your taxes at Service Guelph. They have limited services there. You'll have to buy your bus pass before July 6th. Parking fees go back into effect July 6th. What else is going on? Curbside pickup at the library. So things are getting back to some kind of relative normalcy. I think I'm curious about whether people are, I think people are ready, but I wonder, because we've seen this happen all over different places that have reopened, you know, what the end result is going to be. Do people keep up the caution on social distancing? Do people even come back out at all? Are they worried about maybe COVID is more of a problem than they think? Anyway, I'll let you open up to your thoughts about what you've been seeing.
Yeah, no worries. I've been to a couple stores. I had to go in the mall the other day to get new glasses. It's been really weird going into places. Now, I'll describe briefly my eye doctor appointment. I went in there, and they wouldn't let you pass the little double door entrance until I had sanitized everything, including my phone. And then they're only doing two people at a time on the two wings of the building. So I went to one wing. And the person at the desk served me, and then the next person was waiting for me. I went to them, and then I went to the next person, and I went with the doctor. So it was like my own, like, experience. It was like a VIP experience at the eye. I've never had anything like that. It was really strange. You got, like, seven staff people staring at you as you're walking around. They made it lots of fun, so it was fine. But, I mean, that's an example of, and if you haven't been out yet, this is what the new normal looks like. And I think that's something you'll see in a lot of places. The mall is a little bit worrying because when I went there, there were, you know, that parking lot was full. So I can't imagine physical distancing is happening in every situation, but I'm sure they're trying their best. I mean, community spread in Guelph has been pretty, to be honest, in comparison to a lot of other places, we killed that curve. So, you know, and it doesn't seem like the numbers popped up too much after the protests. So, things are opening back up. You know, if you feel comfortable, go out. It seems like a lot of the businesses are, of course, following those rules, and you have to wear masks inside the stores. Don't forget that.
Right, that's a good point because I think that was the big concern, the big test was the BLM protest, and it has been more than 2 weeks since then, and we have not seen a huge jump in case counts. But I also think that's because we haven't there were it was a weird situation where I can't say obviously out of 5,000 people everyone was wearing masks, but I can say that. There were so many people in masks that if I had saw someone not wearing a mask, it would have stuck out like a sore thumb.
Yeah, like the adoption rates for masks at that protest was very high. If like it, high 90s, I would think from what I saw point of view. And the organizers were given a good example by wearing their masks when they weren't speaking. So that was always good. But yeah, it's a new world out there for sure. And I'm very curious, and I'm excited to go down there with the camera when those patios start creeping up on the road and taking over the pavement. That's going to be an interesting sight. And I think Jennifer Keesmaat's tweet saying that Guelph will become a new hot destination in southern Ontario if we move forward when we move forward with this patio plan. And that'll be interesting. Do you think that they're going to be able to keep the physical distancing rules with that, or how harsh is that going to be? I'm curious.
It's a good question. The physical distancing thing, because I know outdoors is a bit different than indoors, and of course there's also allowances for, you know, social circles now that you could have up to 10 people in the same circle from different houses, sort of interacting. It'll be an interesting experiment. I am dubious about the whole, like, Guelph is going to be a mecca for people who want to hang out in patios. That seems a bit over the top to me. But I mean, I think the administration of this is going to be the real test, not whether or not people are going to be social distancing, because I think people get that, not whether people are going to be wearing masks where they can't physical distance, because I think we're kind of winning that battle too. I think the real question is going to be the logistics of this, whether city staff may feel overwhelmed by the requests, whether there's going to be blowback from other businesses downtown or people living downtown when parking spaces start getting closed off or when streets start getting closed off. Nobody's talking about shutting down Wyndham, at least maybe not yet. Could happen, but the rules are pretty flexible. But you know, they're talking about shutting down Cork or shutting down McDonald or shutting down Douglas, which is, you know, those are side streets where there's not a lot of traffic. Having said that, though, I think there would be a lot of people upset if we were to start changing the traffic flow downtown, and you know, what will that blowback look like? And also at the same time, how many businesses will be able to come back, and how much extra space will they be able to accommodate just from their own sort of logistical standpoint? Because at the end, this is about not what the city of Guelph can do. The city of Guelph has done everything it can do by sort of taking the rules off temporarily. It's going to be up to the businesses in terms of their own capacity and what they can do.
Right. And yeah, it'll be an interesting one to see how, you know, what businesses are able to open, because I did a lot of the business reporting, some with Guelph Mercury and then also myself, where I talked to a lot of business owners, and some, like Ray's Antiques, are just gone now, and some are, you know, struggling, hopefully, you know, kind of crawling to reopening. And another thing I thought is interesting is that this patio arrangement could be a good test for the idea of a carless downtown and a concept, kind of like an incubator guinea test to see how it looks like to, you know, to have a walking around sort of area downtown and how that would look. You know, a disclaimer, I had that on my platform in 2018, is the idea of parts of downtown being carless, but I'm curious if you'll see advocates for that looking at that and saying, you know, maybe that's something we can keep if it works out, or what, you know, what it could mean for the future of downtown.
I don't know. Carless downtown always seems like so pie in the sky to me that, you know, for years you had perhaps legitimate complaints that there wasn't enough parking downtown. So, you know, in terms of bringing people down in cars, and, you know, the counter argument, of course, too, is that there's transit and things like that. But, you know, Guelph isn't like, in so much as, one of the things I found is that people will go to Copenhagen or Vancouver or downtown Toronto and like, look at the great cool car free things that they're doing. And they think they can transplant that here. And I think they live in, I don't want to say a bubble, because I know people get offended if you talk about how they live in bubbles. But I mean, I think there is a very real downtown university, sort of that Gordon Street bubble that people live in, that because, you know, people in that area enjoy walking and enjoy the biking and, you know, are able to be fairly mobile that way. This is still a vast town that you need cars to get around in. And, I have extraordinary doubts about how much people will be able to sell a car-free downtown when people were bombarding the mayor with emails about how they had to wait an extra 10 seconds at red lights because all the walk signals were automated.
Right. You don't think those things can coexist. I hear you.
No, I don't think those things can coexist. And you know, I think people who enjoy the walkability downtown and enjoy that, that ambiance, good for them. You know, they're sort of downtownies, if I can coin that phrase. But there are also a lot of people for whom downtown is a pass-through as they're trying to get to other parts of town or different things on the outskirts of downtown. And I think if they go downtown and they go to turn a corner and they can't because there's picnic tables everywhere, depending on how loud they are about it, that's not going to be a good look on social media. And I'm already kind of seeing a bit of that because before we started talking, I was sort of trolling through Facebook and looking at different posts, and you already have people, you know, rolling their eyes and waving their fists at the idea of closing down streets downtown, and it hasn't even happened yet.
Haven't even experienced it. Yeah, and I noticed that traffic is, you know, starting to pick up again as people are heading back to work and things are reopening, so that's something to consider too, because there was a bit, like, for a while there, and everywhere across the country, I would assume, where streets were empty, right? So you didn't see a lot of the vehicle traffic that you're now are returning back to normal pretty quickly. I would say it's getting back to being really busy. And have you heard anything on the transit end of bringing back more frequent buses? Because it's still on a lower frequency now, right?
Yeah, it's still on Saturday's schedule. No, I think they're keeping the Saturday schedule for now. You know, it's a bit different in the summer anyway, because the university buses are suspended until fall. I mean, that's going to be a big question, is how much of that service is going to come back, and that's going to depend on how much the university is open. I think the city is seeing the more limited schedule as a cost mitigation measure. So I think that's probably, it's probably going to be the Saturday schedule, at least until transit use starts picking up again. And that, as for all the reasons you were outlining, that could be a while too.
Right. And I know that there is a concern at the city or the university level now, like, if, you know, how many students are going to come back? Are they going to keep the UPass contract that students have with it? Because I know the city makes a lot of money from that. So
yeah,
that's going to be a revenue that could be down depending on how many classes are online this fall. And that could be so maybe it could be quite a while if those students don't come back.
Right. The fares from the UPass, we're talking about thousands, tens of thousands of dollars. On the other hand, you could also, I'm not sure how the numbers would break down exactly. You could also view it as a lens that if the university students aren't coming back, yeah, we don't get the UPass revenue. But, you know, you'd also don't have to run the 56, 57, all the various university routes. Those don't run necessarily unless there's the volume of students down in, you know, the Clark Gordon area, you know, catching the bus. That could be a upside in quote marks in terms of the total cost of transit.
Yeah, absolutely.
Before we sign off, I did want to take a few minutes to tackle the whole Marwan Tabara thing, the Kitchener South Hespeler MP who was arrested for numerous charges over the Easter weekend. Here in Guelph, we did not hear about it until earlier this month when the National Post reported it. I think, I it pains me to say it, but I think it's a story that's bigger than Guelph, especially when you get into sort of like the Canadian press reporting that nobody told the speaker he was arrested, and it's one of the rules that that the speaker has to be told when an MP is arrested. The CBC story about long-term, there have been repeated allegations and charges reported about Tabara's conduct since the first campaign in 2015. I think it is. There is a big story to add, you know, in terms of looking at, you know, why somebody was, you know, a sitting MP was a, because I heard this too, that they didn't know he was the MP for Kitchener South. That's where, fair enough. Most people probably don't even know who their own MP is. And two, why it wasn't reported, or three, why we're kind of not talking about it now, because the Guelph Police Service released a statement and said, yeah, we didn't know. We didn't think it was a threat to the public. Please stop asking us about it.
It really begs the question, what are the protocols in place for when you do have someone who's in elected sitting office, you have something like that happen, get arrested? That's kind of a big deal, because that's one of our representatives in the parliament. And you know, the question of why isn't the media automatically informed of these things? And like you said, it seems to be a bigger beyond Guelph issue, but also it's a Guelph concern, because it's looking at also what are Guelph Police Service's policies when it comes to this. And, you know, if this happens again, let's say a Guelph MP gets arrested, are we going to know?
Like, what's the deal? Right. It's, I understand, because when you get the Daily Police press release, I don't know if they do it every day, but it feels like they do it every day, where it says, like, we answered 185 calls today, or we answered 230 calls today. So I don't expect, you know, a press release that outlines all 230 all 230 calls. I mean, perhaps, again, this may be something to think about in the future, but, you know, maybe perhaps some sort of interactive database where you can, you don't necessarily get in the press release, but there is some sort of reporting mechanism where if you have some extra time on your hands, you can go and look and see, oh, okay, they sent a patrol car to downtown because, you know, somebody was yelling at Italian very loudly at people. Rest in peace, Carlos, is what I'm saying. The other side of it too is that Tabara was arrested. He was held overnight, and then they took him to London to be arraigned on Good Friday. And I understand that perhaps Tabara was not perceived as a threat to the public, and that the charges were against it, sort of an identifiable person. The charges against him were because he involved an identifiable person, so he wasn't like going on a crime spree or something. From that perspective, I understand that. However, He was dangerous enough to be held in detention overnight and then taken to the next jurisdiction over on a holiday to be immediately arraigned. That does not say, hey, it was cool. We kind of brought him in and then we told him to come back to court, the next business day.
Yeah.
That was not exactly a chill situation. I mean, sometimes you read in the press releases, right? Like, so-and-so was charged for theft under $5,000. They're going to be arraigned on this court date 3 weeks hence or a month hence. So you do read that. He was taken to London on a holiday and arraigned.
Right.
I think, is a key distinction that has to be acknowledged.
And I think it's obvious, in my opinion, it seems as though that was a clear decision. Like, when they are making this arrest and he is being moved to another city, there's a reason for why that's all happening. And there's an intention there to not have that, go out to beyond that and go to the news. And I think at that point, and this is not for really us to consider, but right. Maybe for legislators to consider, is at that point, like, where does public interest come in and freedom of the press and the right to know what's going on with your elected officials? When does that line get crossed, and when is that a big enough deal for them to know? And it's interesting because I'm looking at one of the articles past this, and Trudeau said he became aware of the charges the morning of June 5, the same day that Tabera gave a statement to the Mercury Tribune. So it's like even the prime minister didn't know right away. And it's kind of interesting why those things don't happen quicker.
Well, he says he didn't know.
Right. That is true. There's a claim that says he doesn't know.
And there's a very specific bit of language error. It says he didn't know about the charges till right. that morning. Now, we can treat that with some degree of skepticism. But what's been clear from the further reporting is that the Liberal Party certainly was aware that there was some serious stuff hounding Tabera. That CBC article did say that some of the allegations from the internal Liberal investigations had been substantiated. So there was certainly enough that the leader of the party should have been aware, somebody should have been saying to him, hey, there's some stuff going on with Marwan Tabera. Because at the end of the day, on all the nomination papers, the leader's signature is on there. So at some point, Justin Trudeau approved Marwan Tabera to run as the Kitchener South Hespeler candidate in 2019, even after everything the party had been hearing. So he doesn't get away with it, is what I'm saying.
Right. There's some responsibility there that comes with his name being, on that paper. Yeah. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I think that it's definitely, I would hope, at least from a reporter's standpoint, that there's a conversation now about how to avoid something like that happening again, and that hopefully there's a mechanism, but we'll have to see what, if there's any, I'm not sure how that would come about, like if that's something that needs to be legislated or if that's like the police board makes that decision. Maybe you have more insight on that, but I don't know where that decision would come from, but that's maybe something that should be considered.
I would also argue that we need more people power in the media. I think, we've all taken it on the chin on this story and, perhaps understandable. But at the same time, as the media in Guelph, the people who are trying to stand up for the people, we kind of need to have the power of the people behind us. And, that just isn't there, I think, in Guelph. That I think that a lot of the institutions in town, be it the city, be it the Guelph Police Service, be it the university, I don't think they're afraid of local media. And I think that has been borne out in stories like the Dave Scott Thomas affair. It took the Globe and Mail to come in before the university decided to fire that track coach. He was on suspension, and then the Globe calls up the university and says, hey, we have all these questions, and 3 days later he's gone. So I don't think – it seems a bit weird to say, like, they should fear us. But but I really think there has to be some element of – and again, this speaks to this inbred Guelph desire for everyone to be friends. But, you know, we can be friendly – but at the end of the day, we're not friends with the people in power. At least we're not supposed to be friends with the people in power. There's supposed to be some kind of adversarial relationship, because that's why that's why accountability is so important. And I don't think it's there. And I don't think it's because we in the media aren't trying. I think it's because the power of the people isn't behind us. Not to put the blame on the, I'm certainly not putting the blame on the listeners of this show or the readers of Guelph Politico. Many of whom are also contributors and do understand that. But I do think in a town of, you know, almost 150,000 people now, there's woeful investment in our local media structures. And if you don't want a Tabara to happen again, we need the power of the people.
Yeah, this is the time. Power in numbers and people coming together to... definitely to back local media, because one of the most important things, and it's what matters. I mean, I saw a clipping the other day of a Guelph Mercury story from 2007 that my parents kept, where I was on the front after I ran a 10K downtown. And those are just tiny memories that happen and things that are important, and things that happen in the community that beyond Tabara stories, which are also important. There's also those community stories that matter to people, and you can go back and say, look, this happened and that happened. There's our city growing. It's our community growing. You're right. There's an adversarial relationship with those in power. We need to hold them accountable. And then there's also there should also be a want by the community to have a strong media so that we can write the history of the city that we live in an honest and clear way, and that those things can be remembered and brought back up, like the newspaper clipping. Now it's online, but you know, same kind of thing, right? Like that. There's many reasons why local media is just so important, and it's So go to GuelphPolitico.ca. Absolutely.
Well, what about your site?
Well, I think GuelphWire is a temporary COVID-19 project, so I'm not going to try and push it out there too much, but. It's a good read if you ever want to dive deep into some of this, some of the different issues going on, you know, around the Black Lives Matter protests, or usually pick a specific issue and kind of go in depth with it. So if you want to check that out, go for it, GuelphWire.ca. But definitely go sign up for Guelph Politico if you haven't already. That's the first place to go to.
Well, I wasn't fishing for that, but thank you. And I know that Guelph Wire is... perhaps not long for this world, because you and Jack have to go back to school eventually.
Unfortunately.
But this was a lot of fun, and I'm glad we were able to do another Guelph stuff, because I did look in my calendar and it had been a while since I had done one of these with anyone, let alone you. So I'm glad we could take this time to catch up. So Eli Ritter, thank you so much. And once again, that was Eli Ritter, and you can find him on Twitter at Eli Ritter, E-L-I-R-I-D-D-E-R. And you can read his stuff over at GuelphWire.ca. And for more information on any of the things we talked about on this week's podcast, you can find them on Guelph Politico at GuelphPolitico.ca. And that is it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. The Guelph Politicast is usually recorded at CFRU at the University Center on the University of Guelph campus. And to learn more about CFRU, go to cfru.ca. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can download it from the host Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you will get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at AdamADonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at AdamADonaldson or at Guelph Politico. You can also go to Guelph Politico's Facebook page, which you can find at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico. And you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all this local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you next week. And until then, see you next time.